Welcome to Prostate Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Oliver Sartor for an update on the rapidly evolving database on systemic therapy of prostate cancer, and Dr. Sartor began our conversation by profiling some of the key developments in the past year.
Neil, there have been actually a rather remarkable series of changes in the last year. Starting really at last year's AUA, there was the discussion on sickle cell T, the new vaccine, that showed a prolongation in overall survival in their large 512-patient trial that was submitted to the FDA in November of 2009, and their PDUFA date is going to be May 1st. So conceivably, there could even be a new vaccine for the metastatic minimally symptomatic patient with castrate-refractory prostate cancer that would be FDA approved in May of 2010. That would be pretty fantastic. I think we've also gained additional insights with regard to the continuing hormonal sensitivity of what we have referred to as castrate-resistant or castrate-refractory prostate cancer. New agents such as abiraterone, MDV-3100, have really pretty surprising activity in patients that we thought previously were refractory to hormonal manipulation. So now those phase threes are winding their way through the system. The first of the phase threes from abiraterone, so-called Cougar 301, completed accrual last year, and conceivably we may even have some results on that this year. In addition, we also have new data on denosumab. This is a monoclonal antibody. They had a large phase three looking skeletal-related events. The data has not yet been presented in a peer-reviewed form, but on February 9th of 2010, there was data to indicate from Amgen in a press release that their primary endpoint was met and there was a hazard ratio of 0.8 with an improvement in skeletal-related events for those individuals receiving the denosumab. And then in a presentation that I was involved in, gave out in San Francisco GU, the cabazitaxel data, which indicated even when patients had progressed beyond Taxotere, metastatic castrate refractory progression after Taxotere, that cabazitaxel gave an overall survival advantage as compared to mitoxantrone in the so-called TROPiC trial. So it's really been an eventful year, lots of new progress.
It's interesting. You mentioned press releases, and there's another one that's out there that I think a lot of people found amazingly disappointing about the BEV study. Maybe you can comment on that.
Well, you know, the CLGB put together really a tremendous effort, 1,000-patient trial with docetaxel plus or minus bevacizumab. A lot of enthusiasm in the field for it. Obviously, the bevacizumab story has turned out to be positive for other diseases, and the hope was it to be positive here. Well, it wasn't. And CLGB put forth a lot of effort. And the bottom line was that even though we haven't seen the results, we know that the bottom line, overall survival was not better. And that's a disappointment. We were hoping in the field to make progress there.
So maybe we can pick up on each one of these. You mentioned the vaccine sickle cell T. What's the actual target and mechanism of action there? And what do you see clinically in terms of side effects, tolerability?
Well, an interesting question. Its mechanism is unlike any vaccine that you may be familiar with. So the first thing that is actually done is that lymphocytes are removed from individual patients. So you have to have a apheresis. You actually have to obtain the white cells from an individual patient. That's shipped off to a manufacturing plant. And there what they use is two things. First of all, a fusion protein between prostatic acid phosphatase and another molecule called GM-CSF. And that is the vaccine part. So it's an ex vivo vaccine. They mix the cells and a little bit of a witch's brew, the IL-6, IL-4 variety of constituents, do the vaccine ex vivo, ship the cells back to the patient, and the patient gets reinfused. They do that every 2 weeks for three treatments. So this vaccine is really interesting. It's prepared differently than any other vaccine. And, of course, it actually, in the large randomized trial, showed a prolonged survival.
So can you track out any better why it has an anti-tumor effect? What's it targeting?
Well, the prostatic acid phosphatase is presumably the target, and that is made rather specifically in prostate cells. But the thing that's a little bit hard to fathom about it is that it doesn't seem to induce responses, and it doesn't seem to change the progression-free survival. The overall endpoint, the primary endpoint of overall survival was positive, but PFS and response rates were really not different between the placebo group and the sickle cell T group.
If the drug were available right now, how would you utilize it outside a protocol setting in your practice?
Well, you know, I think the indication is going to be pretty clear. The patient's going to have castrate-resistant disease. They're going to have metastatic disease. And they're going to have either no symptoms or minimal symptoms. So within that context, I think there are going to be a lot of men who fit. And I think there'll be a lot of enthusiasm for incorporating this agent into practice.
Any side effects and toxicity?
Yes. Yeah, so with the cellular infusion, you have the potential for chills, rigors, fever, kind of acute phase type reactions, flu-like syndromes. Other than that, it actually seems to be quite safe.
So basically, you give it three times and sort of wait?
Well, you know, it's sort of interesting. You give it three times, and then the progression is not going to differ from that of a placebo, and the response isn't going to condition. So quite frankly, I think what's going to happen is we're then just going to go on to the next therapy. So it won't really interfere with the administration of the next therapies. Now, I think we'll probably want to stay away from a lot of corticosteroids, things that may, you know, sort of suppress the immune response. And we don't have a huge amount of data about interactions with chemotherapy, steroids, et cetera. So there's more that we need to learn.
Let's talk about your presentation at the GU Symposium on carbazotaxel.
Well, again, we have a large phase 3 trial, which of course, where we really learn things about whether or not drugs work or not. And it was 755 patients. It was 26 different countries, 146 different sites. All the patients had to have metastatic and castrate-resistant prostate cancer and have progressed after docetaxel treatment. So these are really tough patients. They've already pre-chemotherapy treated. So this is a second-line chemotherapy. Randomization was to a new agent called cabazitaxel versus an older agent, mitoxantrone, that is FDA approved and commonly used in this setting. And the bottom line was that there was a prolongation in survival, overall survival in the cabazitaxel treated group. Hazard ratio was excellent at 0.7. Median survival in the mitoxantrone group was 12.7 months. In the cabazitaxel group, it was 15.1 months. So about a 2.4 median difference in overall survival curves. But the curves split very, very nicely, and the hazard ratio was excellent at 0.7. And I'm thinking this is a game changer. I think this is going to go to the FDA later this year, and I'm thinking it'll be approved.
Now, by its name, I assume it's a taxane similar to paclitaxel?
It is. It's, you know, from the genius of medicinal chemists where they start with a taxane base and then begin to modify the basic structure. And the bottom line is they found a series of structural changes, methoxy groups on the top of several rings, that would have activity even when the conventional taxanes had failed. And exactly why that's true is somewhat debatable. But the bottom line is they demonstrated it in their animal models. They had reasonable results in their phase 1, took it to phase 3, and now there's a positive overall survival benefit.
So is this going to be compared to another taxane such as docetaxel?
Well, I think it will certainly have the opportunity to move up and be compared to others. I know right now that Sanofi Ventus, which is the patent holder of the drug and the developer of the drug, that they're very interested in looking at a wide variety of cancers. You know, we all know that breast cancer, lung cancer, other cancers are going to be looked at in a very rapid fashion because this novel taxane has activity when the conventional ones have failed.
What about side effects and toxicity with this agent compared to other taxanes, particularly paclitaxel?
Well, it's fairly taxane-like in its toxicity profile with the exception of neuropathies. And this was something I didn't really understand because taxanes are very neuropathy-prone, but this one isn't. So in terms of grade 3, 4 toxicities, the one that were worrisome, febrile neutropenia, about 7.5%, fatigue and asthenia, and then some diarrhea. And diarrhea was about 4.5%, 5%, fatigue and asthenia, both about 5%.
Any sort of global comparison in prostate cancer where, of course, there's a lot of docetaxel being used right now in terms of just overall tolerability, quality of life with this new agent compared to docetaxel?
Well, it's really hard to compare because the data that we really have is in the docetaxel failures. And one thing that was kind of instructive here, so mitoxantrone has been used both upfront And here it was used second line, and we have real data. So if we look at kind of grade 3-4 neutropenia in the frontline setting, it's 22% grade 3-4 for mitoxantrone frontline. But it's in the mid-50s, I think it's about 56% in the second-line setting. So it's not just the drug that has to be evaluated, it's the patient population as well. So with the cabazitaxel, there is a pretty high incidence, about 80% of grade 3-4 neutropenia. Febrile neutropenia, 7.5%. How will that look frontline? My prediction is it's going to look a lot better frontline because the patients are not going to be as beat up.
What about growth factors?
Well, certainly growth factors were allowed in the trial, but they weren't encouraged. They did not meet the ESCO guidelines in terms of administration prophylactically. But certainly I know that the growth factors will be used, and I think that'll be a good idea, quite frankly.
I mean, and again, assuming you can prevent infections, and, you know, neutropenia is not really, I would say, a quality of life issue exactly. What about other quality of life issues, again, docetaxel versus this new agent?
Well, honestly, Neil, we don't really have good comparative data yet, and I think that'll take some head-to-head trials in order to really get a feeling. My sense is that you've got a little more neutropenia with this agent and probably about the same amount of diarrhea, but you probably have less neuropathy with this agent. So I think it's going to be a little more neutropenic than the other taxanes.
Anything new or even in your own clinical observations in terms of docetaxel in metastatic disease? It's now been a while since the data has been available. You think it's being utilized and when it should be utilized in community-based practice and any, you know, sort of clinical pearls about utilizing it?
Well, I think there are a couple of things we've learned since it came out. You know, first of all, you can't be too quick on the trigger in terms of stopping it. You know, there were some initial data that indicated that PSAs may rise when you're put on docetaxel originally, but that doesn't mean just because you receive one cycle or maybe even two cycles and have a PSA rise that you've progressed. Many of those patients have a bit of a PSA flare. 20-25% of the patients would go on and have what may be now termed a flare and then stabilize their disease going forward and maybe even respond to it. So first of all, I think, you know, from my perspective, I'm pretty committed to trying to give three cycles of docetaxel minimum before I make any decisions about what's happening with the patient. The second point in follow-up, if you will, it used to be, I think, that docetaxel was really almost a last-ditch effort. You know, the patient had failed multiple secondary hormonal manipulations. Their performance status was declining, and you say, okay, well, all of our options are gone. We'll try chemo. I think today, most practitioners are really familiar enough with docetaxel. They've moved it up in the scheme a little bit. You don't have to wait till somebody is circling the drain before you start it.
You know, another thing that I started to hear from investigators, it seemed like it kind of changed, was the issue of using chemo in general and docetaxel specifically in PSA-only disease. Initially, people were like, no, you know, let's wait for the data. And then it seemed like, maybe I'm wrong, but it seemed like with increasing sensitivity to the PSA doubling time, particularly in younger patients, that some investigators started to kind of think about that. What about that strategy outside of protocol setting and anything new in terms of new trial results looking at that?
So we don't have any new trial results. And I think, you know, if a drug is active later, it's probably going to be active earlier too. It's hard to really give data because we don't have it. But what I'll say is that as we've begun to sort of exhaust our secondary hormones, there's sometimes a gap in what we have in the clinic and waiting for that metastatic disease. Using the docetaxel in that setting is used, but we just don't have a lot of data. I'm not going to say it's right. I'm not going to say it's wrong. I've done it at times. I know good doctors have done it. And then the question is, you know, what do you do when the docetaxel fails? And finally, I think we might have an opportunity to explore that option with cabazitaxel, but we have to wait for it to be approved.
So let's talk about your patients. They really look interesting. How about this first man?
So here's a patient who is having castrate-resistant disease. Turns out he's about 57 years old. He presented with high Gleason score disease. He was Gleason 8. Initially, it was organ confined, got operated on. Unfortunately, PSA began to rise after the operation. He then got salvage radiation without hormones, didn't work. PSA kept going up. pretty rapid doubling time. He was at a PSA doubling time, about 4 month type of guy, which is not a good prognosis. Went on hormones when there was no evidence of metastatic disease, failed hormones, and when he did, it was not only with the PSA rising, but this painful area in his sacrum. So this guy had bad kinetics. He was a high Gleason score from the beginning. He ended up failing rapidly after the radical prostatectomy, I think it was only about 7 or 8 months later. Went to salvage radiation, no response, and then gets on hormones and doesn't have a prolonged response and then fails and he's beginning to progress rapidly and presents with symptoms. So this guy, unfortunately, is a bad actor from the outset.
And so at that point, how is he treated?
Well, we started off with some external beam to the sacral lesion because that gives the palliation he needs. I mean, you don't want people in pain. In fact, is, you know, if you don't control pain, you don't control anything. I mean, everything else is subsidiary to controlling pain. And, you know, at that time, we talked to him about what else to do. We put him on some secondary hormones. At that time, did not put him on zoledronic acid. Ended up treating him with DES, which is an older regimen. And he had a stabilization of his PSA on the secondary DES, but not really a response. And then, unfortunately, began to have additional PSA rises. And when he got re-scanned, he was, unfortunately, now developed new metastasis, and this time it was hepatic. So he's got visceral metastatic disease, rising PSA, failed secondary hormones.
So what did you do at that point?
Well, you know, I told him, you know, with visceral disease and with continued rapid progression, I don't want to go use additional secondary hormones at this point. I mean, I could have put him on ketoconazole or something like that. I said, look, we need to go on to docetaxel. And that's the one that's proven to prolong survival. We have prospective randomized trials. We have, you know, not one, we have two trials. It's FDA approved. That's what we need to do. And we did. And he initially had PSA stabilization, really didn't respond, but he stabilized as opposed to having rapid progression. But then about six cycles into the docetaxel, which he tolerated reasonably well, by the way, he turned out to have two new hepatic lesions and he had new bone lesions. So the guy's, you know, again, progressing despite the docetaxel therapy. We keep him on the LHRH analogs. He's continued to be castrate. He's failed secondary hormones, failed chemotherapy. Now we got a real tiger by the tail.
So what happened?
Well, we ended up putting him on the TROPiC trial. And in order to qualify for the trial, you had to have a reasonable performance status, ECOG 012. You had to have good hematopoietic function, you know, regular white count, platelet count, hemoglobin sort of things. LFT is said to be okay. And we put him on cabazitaxel. And so it turned out it was randomized. It was not a double-blind trial. It's hard to double-blind with mitoxantrone because you got the blue juice going in. But, you know, he developed some neutropenia right off the bat. We put in the growth factors and kept him out of that. And then he ended up being treated for six cycles, and that turned out to be median. He did not have an objective response in his hepatic lesion, and it did not shrink, but he had no new lesions develop. And his PSA, again, stabilized. We didn't have a response, but it stabilized. And so we carried him through for six cycles, and then unfortunately he did begin to progress both by PSA and he developed some more lesions.
So looking back on his case, do you have the sense that he benefited from treatment? Or I guess maybe you don't know.
Well, you know, I think that he did, but, you know, that's something difficult to really evaluate outside of a prospective randomized trial. What I can tell you based on the randomized trial is that people received, on average, before going into the TROPiC trial, about seven cycles of the docetaxel. And seven cycles, as it turns out, is kind of what's given on average in the United States. So he was fairly typical. Now, he had visceral disease, and visceral disease was only present in 25% of the patients who received cabazitaxel or mitoxantrone. But given this rapid progression, and this is a guy who received the best therapies we knew how to give, he was still progressing. I think he did benefit, but nevertheless, you know, he ended up dying around 13 months later. And unfortunately, this is really tough disease. And we don't have cures with cabazitaxel. We have a prolongation in the progression-free survival. We have better overall survival, but we still have more work to do.
Now, what about non-hematologic toxicity in his situation? Neurotoxicity, any problems?
No neurotoxicity. He had some diarrhea, grade 1-2 diarrhea. We gave him some Lamotil, and that worked it out.
What about clinical trials right now looking at chemotherapy in general and earlier stage disease? We were talking about PSA-only disease, even in the high-risk situation. Where are we with that?
Well, one thing is, and I'm pleased to play a role, and I'm also a co-principal investigator on RTOG-0521, this cooperative group trial run through the Radiation Therapy Oncology Group. And they have randomized over 600 patients, all of whom had high-risk prostate cancer, but localized prostate cancer. And here we're talking about the Gleason 8, 9, 10s, the T3, T4 diseases and diagnosis, but no evidence of metastasis. And the standard of care there is to treat them with 2 to 3 years of hormones and radiation therapy. Everybody receives standard of care. And then randomization 1-to-1 between no docetaxel and docetaxel for 6 cycles. That trial, again, has completed accrual, so it's in, you know, the assessment phase right now.
Any speculations about when it might report?
Well, the way the endpoint is done, it's got a 4-year sort of cut point to take a look at the data. So it'll probably be about 3.5 years or so we'll get an initial look. But as you know, these patients can live for a long time. And it may be a while before we really understand, but at least the trial is done. It's the first trial fully accrued in this space. There have been some SWOG trials, mitoxantrone, you know, looking at some of these patients who are higher risk, and they've been very, very slow to report. And I think many of the patients ended up having like Gleason 6 disease, may have looked bad on paper, but they really didn't progress very rapidly. It's a big difference I think we now appreciate between the Gleason 6 and then the Gleason 8, 9, 10s.
Let's talk about your second patient, the 59-year-old man.
So he is a fellow who comes in, initially had a palpable nodule. He had a PSA of 5.3, but 2 years ago, his PSA was 1.6. So he had a pretty significant jump in his PSA. He had an abnormal digital rectal exam, gets his biopsies done, and 5 out of 12 are positive. And he's got a mix. He's got a couple of 3 plus 3s, but he's got a 4 plus 3 equals 7 in 3 of his biopsies. And the bottom line is, when you start having Gleason 4 predominant, you start really having to worry about it. These guys are really more like a Gleason 8 than they are a Gleason 6. And, you know, the 7s I really divide between the 3 plus 4s and the 4 plus 3s. This guy's a 4 plus 3, and with a rapidly rising PSA prior to diagnosis, scans negative for metastatic disease.
So what was the next step?
Well, you know, trying to counsel him on what to do. And, you know, if you got a patient who's got a Gleason 4 plus 3 and he's a pretty healthy guy, 59-year-old guy, you know, you can talk about doing surgery. You can talk about doing radiation plus hormones. You cannot talk about observation or surveillance in these type of guys. Went over the options, ended up choosing prostatectomy. He actually was one of the fairly early robotic prostatectomy guys, and turned out that everything was fine and he had an uneventful recovery. But it turned out that he was pathologic T3A. He had some extracapsular extension, and his PSA was down, and all his lymph nodes were down. So he was a pathologic T3A N0. PSA turned out to be, afterwards, checked in about 6 weeks, undetectable. Talked to him a little bit about what he wanted to do, and he just said, look, let's just wait and see how things go. Had some incontinence and wanted to try to get over his continence issues.
Then what?
Well, we watched him and kept pretty good eyes on him, and as it turned out, his PSA began to go up. And at about a 12-month follow-up, it was about 0.15, and then 13, 14, it was 0.23, 0.31. DRE was unremarkable, but, you know, obviously we're all concerned about the PSA rise, and again, we sit down and start talking about what to do. Well, the way I look at it, and, Neil, I think this actually is an important point, there are two ways to cure prostate cancer. You can cure it with surgery, you can cure it with radiation, but hormones don't cure people. So at this point, the guy had only one curative option, and that was going to be with radiation. We debate on whether or not hormones plus radiation are better than radiation alone. We don't know the answer to that. There's another RTOG trial beginning to address that question. But the bottom line is that some of these patients can be salvaged with external beam, And in my patients, I'm pretty aggressive in using it. I say, look, you know, we need to get some external beam in here, see if it's going to work.
Although it kind of seems like he might not be the patient that, you know, with the rapid PSA and the initial high stage that you'd think would get cured by adjuvant radiation therapy.
Well, you're right. And actually, I'm going to pick a little distinction with you. This would not be adjuvant. This would be salvage.
Right.
Adjuvant would be administered if there's no evidence of any recurrence, but salvage if there is.
Mm-hmm.
You're absolutely right. There are parameters that have been published about who is likely to respond to salvage radiation, who is not. The higher the Gleason score, the worse the prognosis. The more rapid the doubling time, the worse the prognosis. The higher the PSA, the worse the prognosis. And we jumped right on this guy. We didn't wait till the PSA was high. But unfortunately, you know, his Gleason score wasn't perfect. And in addition, he did not have margin positive. So margin positive is actually a good thing for salvage radiation. He did not have margin positive. So I wasn't sure that he was going to respond. In fact, as we might even argue that he would not respond. But I know if I didn't give it, there was no chance of him being cured. So my modus operandi is give the guy the opportunity to get cured. Let's give a shot with the radiation, see what happens, even though the odds are against him.
So what happened?
Well, we radiated him, and it didn't work. He had a little downward blip in his PSA. It went from like 0.31 to 0.19, but it didn't stay down. And sure enough, what we feared would happen is what happened, and the PSA is starting to go forward and rise up.
So then what?
Well, we get in this sort of awkward scenario. You know, we've been using hormonal therapy here for years, and we don't actually have great data to show that it's effective. But the alternative is to either put him on a clinical trial or observe him. You know, his PSA is going up. He's anxious. We don't really have a good clinical trial in this space. I put him on intermittent hormones. And the way I do that is, you know, I'll use a bicalutamide and LHRH channel combo. Use it for 6 months. If their PSA goes down to an undetectable range, I'll just stop the hormonal therapy, monitor the PSA and testosterone closely, and then reinitiate, typically when the PSA is around 3 or 4.
Now, you've presented some work looking at the rapidity with which the PSA drops and the benefit. Can you comment on that and what actually happened with this man?
Well, you know, it's a very interesting topic. Let me back up just a moment because it's really a subset of PSA kinetics. So we know that if your PSA goes up rapidly before you're diagnosed, that that's not good. We know that after radiation, and this has been published in large trials, if your PSA falls rapidly, that is not good, surprisingly. And so we wanted to ask the question in patients who had hormonal treatment, and in this case it was metastatic disease, if it fell rapidly, was that bad or good? Now, if the PSAs are real low, you can't really dissect this out very well because you don't get a good handle on the kinetics. You start and then the PSAs go down. You have to have people who start high in order to really be able to observe the kinetics. So we did that. And it turned out those people with a rapid drop actually had the worst prognosis. So think about it this way. It's all about kinetics. If you rise rapidly or fall rapidly, that puts you into a disease category where probably the tumor cells are turning over rapidly. And whether it's radiation or hormones, rapid tumor proliferation is not a good sign. And when you fail and those tumor cells are rapidly proliferating, that puts you in a poor prognostic group. We also know about PSA doubling time. We know lots about PSA doubling time now. So after radical prostatectomy, after radiation, you have a poor PSA doubling time, 3-4 month PSA doubling time. That puts you into a poor prognostic group.
Interesting. So what happened with this man?
Well, you know, he ended up going on intermittent hormones. And he initially had a good response, as we typically do. But, you know, part of the problem that we have ongoing here is that the hormonal therapy doesn't last forever in anybody. And even though we kind of put him on and then took him off, it turns out that his PSA started to rise when he still had a castrate testosterone. And so he never really got to the point where he was on, you know, intermittent therapy in the usual sense. We stopped his hormones, But his PSA goes up, and he never recovered his testosterone. He's castrate refractory practically from the beginning. And we rescan him, you know, get him back going on his LHRH. But now he's non-metastatic. He has no evidence of metastases, but his PSA is rising.
So then what?
Under those circumstances, what we've been doing typically is secondary hormonal manipulations. I use things like nalutamide, which is an alternative to bicalutamide and flutamide. And very few patients have seen nalutamide. Some of the patients get a reasonable response. Prednisone, ketoconazole, hydrocortisone, you know, discussions about clinical trials in this setting, but we don't have a huge amount, although ZD4054 is going forward here. And what we did actually is put him on ketoconazole and hydrocortisone, which is a pretty active agent.
And so what happened?
Well, he's responded, and I don't really have a lot more follow-up. So he's responding. The PSA is coming down on ketoconazole, and we'll take that just as long as we can take it.
How about your third patient?
So he's a little bit of an older guy. He's about 69 at this point. He had been treated earlier in a definitive way, got treated with radiation. Unfortunately, had about a four-year period, PSA began to rise. And if you've already treated with radiation, you know, you might have the option of salvage prostatectomy, but he really wasn't interested in that. And the side effects are substantial and the success rates are not very high. And he ended up being put on an LHRH analog. And his PSA doubling time was not nearly as bad. It was about a year or so. And we had put him on intermittent hormones, and he'd been on intermittent hormones for about 5 years or so before he became refractory. And his PSA was rising, and we started rechecking things, and now he has metastatic disease. And it's bone only, and really he doesn't have a lot of symptoms at this point. This guy is a pretty healthy, metastatic, but relatively asymptomatic castrate refractory patient.
So what were you thinking?
Well, again, I'm thinking secondary hormones. And at that time, the sickle cell T trial was ongoing. You know, we discussed about whether or not I might refer him to one of those trial centers, but it was a placebo-controlled trial. He'd have to travel. He really didn't quite want to get involved with that. And I used, again, ketoconazole and hydrocortisone. He had a bit of a response, but not a terrific response, and began to rise. And then, you know, we get into this conundrum of what to do. You know, he's now failed a secondary hormone. He's still really asymptomatic, minimally symptomatic. And what do you do now?
So I guess theoretically, this is sort of the subset that now we know seems to have benefited by the vaccine.
Correct. And, you know, this would be a guy who potentially could benefit from the vaccine. You know, he's castrate resistant, he's metastatic, but he's minimally symptomatic. This is where the new vaccine might come into play.
So with this type of clinical presentation, how would you see the vaccine being integrated sequentially with chemotherapy, specifically docetaxel?
Well, you know, they're two very, very different agents. And I don't regard it as an either-or decision. I review them as actually complementary. So, you know, from a side effect profile, you have chemotherapy-type side effects with neutropenias, diarrheas, fatigue associated with taxanes. But for this type agent, you know, you got some kind of rigors and chills that might be associated with reinfusion, but not really much thereafter. So I would think that, you know, going to the vaccine would make sense. Now, he's either going to need to follow that with additional secondary hormones or move on to chemo. So how you do that, we're still sort of working with. But what I will say is that there's no data to suggest that chemotherapy is less effective post-vaccine. And until we have more data, it's hard to say if it'll be more effective. But nevertheless, I think we carry on with our usual type therapies after progression post-vaccine.
So what happened with this man?
Well, we did talk some more about Provenge, but it's not yet available. And he had started on taxotere prednisone and kind of the typical type stuff. And it turned out that he was having initial PSA decline about 35%. That actually is meaningful. There are nice studies now done on both TAX-327, the big original prednisone docetaxel trial, to show that if you get 30% or more PSA decline, you're probably going to be living longer. And this patient achieved that. But as it turned out, he was beginning now to have progression after about 7 cycles, and he had both bone scan and CAT scan progression, but he still got a good performance status. So, you know, this is a bit of a conundrum. I mean, he's failing his Taxotere, he's got a good performance status, and at this point, I did not have the TROPiC trial available for him. So we got to go through what to do when docetaxel fails, and it's not an easy discussion.
So what happened?
Well, you know, we talked to him, and as it turned out, he was a little bit positive on the chemo. He had tolerated it well, and I ended up using a docetaxel carboplatin combo on him. That is not FDA approved. We have published on it, and it has about a 20% response rate using PSA 50% decline as a response rate. Some patients do pretty well. It's better tolerated than you might think, and currently he's receiving that now.
How's he tolerating it?
Better than you might think. You know, the carbo is reasonably well tolerated. I do have to use growth factors with it, but nevertheless, he's doing okay. He's a couple of cycles in, and his PSA is no longer rising. Whether or not he'll respond, I don't know.
So I never know whether to ask this question or not, and I definitely save it towards the end. But any thoughts about where we are right now in terms of prostate cancer screening? I know you were part of a paper that kind of looked at that, and I read that thing, and I thought, oh my gosh, I don't know if people are going to want to get this complicated about it, but where are we right now?
Well, I think you're referring to the 81-page AUA 2009 PSA update, and I was on that committee. But, you know, I think that what we have are 2 randomized trials, one of which was significantly flawed, and that was the American trial, PLCO. It was so contaminated that I don't think valid conclusions can be drawn. I think that the new American Cancer Society guidelines and the new AUA guidelines are good ones. It really suggests that we inform patients about the pros and cons of screening. We know that if you do get screened, that you can find cancer that you would not have otherwise found. We know that from the European trial, you can reduce the risk of dying from prostate cancer by probably 20, 25%, maybe even a little more if we did annual screening. We don't know the answer to that. But we've got to be prepared to diagnose prostate cancers that don't need to be treated. And if we're going to screen people, we've got to be willing to use surveillance. And I think it's that hump that we need to pay more attention to. Surveillance is underutilized in the U.S. We need to use it more. Not everybody with prostate cancer needs to be treated.
Yeah, that was sort of a theme that came through that tome, 81-page tome, which was, you know, patient education and information that they may be about to getting into something that's going to be kind of difficult. Anything new? And again, getting back to genomic factors, I'm always bugging Steve Schack from Genomic Health. Are you doing anything to try to figure out which one of these patients with Gleason 6 is going to progress? Anything interesting there?
Well, progress, but not to the point that it's about to reach the patient. So we know about the Tempris-Erg translocation. This is the translocation present about half of prostate cancer patients. Some data would suggest that these patients progress more rapidly than others, but other data do not confirm that. Lots of data looking at the Tempris-Erg, Tempris-Etz family translocations. We will learn more about it, and I'm looking forward to learning more about it.